Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. One of the issues that comes up very commonly in our efforts to practice Dhamma, and it's quite prominent in a retreat situation, is the and especially in relationship to trying to develop right effort, is the whole domain of the fear of failure. We're heavily conditioned as human beings, and particularly in Western societies, to worship success. Success is everything, and we tend to look upon success as being an ultimate good, an absolute good, and failure as being an absolute bad, something that's intrinsically wrong and painful. And the conditioning of our society, our education, the world we grow up in, particularly here in the USA, coming from Europe, it's very prominent how strong that conditioning is. Winning is everything. Yeah. These various kind of slogans that one sees around various billboards or different places, that keep pointing to the fact that second place is not good enough. Winning is everything. Yeah, there's the winner and then there's the rest. But second place doesn't count. And this incredibly competitive urge, I mean, competition is a natural enough urge as human beings, but it's very heavily accentuated. And even if we might think, well, I'm not a competitive person, I hate competitive sports, always have done, don't like that kind of stuff. Even if we have that feeling, still that's the ground rules for existence that we've grown up with. You know, the basic shape of the pitch is still there in our conditioning, and we get strongly conditioned by that. I was leading a retreat a few years ago at Spirit Rock, and one of the people was at the end of the retreat. I often have this an evening for people to share their own experiences or reflections on the retreat, and this fellow was describing his experience of doing walking meditation side by side with one of the monks down in the lower walking hall, the lower sort of basement below the shrine room at Spirit Rock. And he described how it started out with him sort of happily walking along, and then this monk shows up and says, "Oh, monk. Okay. Now let's see you can really walk." And so he finds himself trying to out-mindful the other monk, and who can walk more carefully and slowly, and who's more attentive to the turn at the end of the walking path, and trying to walk more slowly than each other. This kind of slowness competition. And it was quite wonderful, really. He was describing all his mental states, saying that this is Dhamma. We shouldn't be competing, but wow, I'm doing better than he is. No. I shouldn't be thinking like that. So it creeps in, isn't it? Isn't it insidious how it just takes over? Trying to be more mindful than the other guy. Walk more slowly than the other guy. Be more selfless than the other guy. I'm sure I'm much more selfless than Ajahn Mehta. Probably more humble too. Not that there's a competition going on. But we just sort of slips in. Yeah. Who moves least? Who breathes most quietly? Who has the less breaths per hour? Who's the jhana champion of the 2007 Thanksgiving retreat? Who's the most equanimous when faced with the wonderful Paul's cooking? It's just smells, tastes, just passing phenomena. It means nothing to me. Utterly equanimous. It's just elements changing shape, that's all. Food inside, food outside. Food outside, food inside. It's just sankharas changing shape, arising and ceasing. Yeah. I have that kind of. Yeah, I'm not driven by greed like her. He's much more obsessed than I am. Look at how equanimous I am. You know, whatever it might be, or maybe think, I've got the biggest kilesas in the entire place. I've got more defilements than anybody here. I'm sure my problems are more spectacular and colourful and pungent than anybody else in the hall. You think you've got obstructions? You don't have a prayer. You know, there's no contest. You know, my hindrances are way, way more spectacular, gigantic, and comprehensive than yours are. It's crazy, isn't it? But this is what the mind can get stuck on, that comparing and competing. And so the conditioning of competition and the desire for success, it just infiltrates into the spiritual domain. So we end up, you know, being attracted towards Buddhism and meditation and wanting to develop our own life in a helpful way, in a skillful way, but that very effort, that interest in truth, in peace and clarity gets unconsciously co-opted by that competitive urge and the desire for success and the fear of failure. So the attraction towards truth and towards peace then gets taken over by this, I want to succeed, I don't want to fail, I don't want to be a failed meditator, I don't want to be the come last in the yogi stakes, get the booby prize for the worst yogi of the retreat. So that sneaks in, kind of creeps in, filters in, and colours our whole perceptions, our whole efforts of working with the mind, trying to establish concentration, trying to develop insight. And trying to do the right thing, trying to fulfill our potential and to perform our roles successfully. Yeah, how worried we can be about what they think about us. What will people think of me? The mysterious they. Have you ever met them? I've spent years, decades and decades worried about what they will think, and I never actually met them. Because it's always somebody else, isn't it? Have you ever thought of that you are one of the them that's thinking about somebody else? Yeah. Do you see what I mean? It's always they. What will they think of me? Or if I get that wrong, what will they think? If I goof up, what will they think? If I get this wrong, what will they think? I don't want to fall apart, because what will people think of me? I don't want to get this wrong, because what will they think? If I hit the wrong note, if I make the wrong move, do something out of order, what will they think? And it's always a sort of blurry mush of themness, theyness. We forget that they are, like everyone gathered here on this retreat, we're actually endeavoring to cultivate kindness and compassion and forgiveness. But we forget that in our sort of anxiety, our fearfulness, our insecurity. And we always feel there's some kind of nebulous threat, some kind of aggression, something sort of frightening and painful that's sort of coming from them. Yeah, even for the most sort of innocuous things. It's mysterious, isn't it? But how commonplace it is, just, and how deep an effect it can have on just the very efforts that we make in our meditation. And the irony, painful irony, is that, you know, we can, because of the fear of failure, we can try so hard, we put so much, you know, energy into trying to get it right, that we try so hard that we end up tripping over our own feet. We kind of disable our own efforts because of the fear of getting it wrong, the desire to get it right, and so that we end up scrambling, disabling our own efforts because of that element filtering its way into what motivates us. So I find it's extremely important and helpful to highlight that quality, to see where it comes in and dominates the mind and the perceptions, just to get familiar with it, to see how it works. Is to contemplate success and failure. You know, these are two of the eight worldly winds that the Buddha described as things that when the practice is well developed, you know, when the Dhamma is realized, then the heart becomes free of these Lokiya Dhammas, the worldly winds, worldly Dhammas. Success and failure, praise and criticism, gain and loss, happiness and unhappiness. These are things that when we experience them, the heart is undisturbed by the presence, whether we're praised or criticized, whether we experience, you know, fame or disrepute, whether we succeed or fail, whether there's pleasure or pain, that there's a stability and equanimity there. Now, when we start to reflect on success and failure, one of the things that we begin to recognize, or if you look at our own lives, we see that sometimes, even though we long for success and we fear failure, probably it wouldn't take too much effort for each one of us to think back to something that we were really pleased that we got, some kind of task we had, or some kind of competition, or some thing that we were aiming for, and we were really glad that we got it. Yeah, you know, there was some kind of achievement. We passed the exam, we got the job, um, we ask somebody out on a date and they said yes, or we asked them to marry us and they said yes, or we got ordained into a particular tradition. We asked to be ordained and the teacher said yes. You can probably tell what's coming next. Then, not too much later, then I think, ah, oh, damn, how did I get into this? Like, gee, did I really sign up for this? Like, oh, wow, this is dreadful. You know, well, it seemed like a good idea at the time. She was such a nice girl. Seemed like such a good school. Or he was so polite when I first met him. Had good manners. And what happened? You know, that which was we were aiming for, that which was a success, passing the exam, you know, getting the qualification, forming the relationship, you know, leaving the country. It promised so much. It seemed like a great thing, and we were really happy to have that success, that result. And then we didn't realize that within that there was contained all kinds of other riders and subsequent implications that came with that. We didn't realize what was there with the package, or what it would lead to, or what we would commit us to, what was going to come with it down the line. Similarly, it probably wouldn't take much thought either, much effort to remember some disaster in our lives, some kind of dreadful mistake that we made an awful choice, or we failed some exam, we got rejected by somebody, or we didn't get, we asked to be ordained in a particular tradition and the teacher said no way, you got to wait, or you proposed to somebody and they said no, sorry, not interested. What, how can you reject me like that? And it's painful, bitter to fail, to lose the race, to not succeed. And then a little while thereafter, there's this the recognition of, wow, I'm really glad I didn't get stuck, didn't get caught up in that one. Or, well, it was painful at the time, but I'm really glad that I didn't get that promotion. Yeah, well, I would have liked it, but I didn't really deserve the job. I'd have loved to have got a first class degree, but actually I really didn't deserve it. I was telling some people today about a friend of ours, actually the Episcopalian minister of a church that we used to have meetings at in San Francisco years ago, St. Aidan's Church up on Diamond Heights. And he was American Episcopalians are much more sort of broad-minded and liberal than the Church of England ministers over on the other side of the pond. So this was a minister. Every 7 years they had a sabbatical. He spent his sabbatical in Japan studying Buddhism and the tea ceremony. That was his sabbatical as a Christian minister. Anyway, when he found out that these Buddhists were having meetings at his church and wanted to do that, he was really keen on this, and he used to take me out and offer me lunch every so often. And one day he was telling me how the job of the bishop, being bishop of Carmel, had come up. And he was just a regular minister, he was an ordinary priest, but he becoming a bishop would be really going up a notch. And then bishop of Carmel, well, that was really a feather in the cap. So he said, I really, really wanted to get that position, you know, not only to be promoted to bishop from being a priest, but also to get a really choice posting like Carmel, right by the sea, charming little town, etc., etc. Clint Eastwood as mayor. All kinds of fancy trimmings. And anyway, he said, I really, really wanted that. And they have this complicated voting system in the Episcopalian church. And there was like, I think, 10 or 15 candidates to begin with. And then they have various rounds of voting. And it boiled down to to him and I think one other candidate. They were the last two in the race. And he was so excited, and he was so keen to get it, and it was just so near. And then the final round of voting came through, and he didn't get it. He said, "I was so devastated. I was so sure. And I wanted it so much, and then it came through, and I was just so disappointed." He said, "For about 6 weeks afterwards, every day my mom was going, 'Oh, it's not fair. I should have got it.'" And grumble. Rant. And he said it was one morning, it was apropos of absolutely nothing whatsoever. I think he was shaving. And wasn't thinking about the subject for a change. Just as he was halfway through shaving, this thought suddenly crossed his mind: the right guy got the job. And he said, "What? Who thought that?" But he realized that floating up through the blur of his protestations and his self-justifications and his complaints and grumbles, there was this insight that actually the right guy got the job. He says, "Well, you know, when you think about it, he was much better qualified, had far more experience, and besides, I only really wanted to become bishop in order to get the feather in my cap. I didn't actually want to fulfill the job of being a bishop. Just wanted the title, you know, and the kudos." And that all just suddenly popped into his mind, all of a piece. And he very shortly thereafter realized, "Well, I'm really glad, actually, in retrospect, that they didn't choose me. Because if they had, I would have been chosen for the wrong reasons. I wouldn't really be suited to it. I wouldn't really be up to the job." So that was a very powerful insight for him. And then 3 years later, actually a little while after that, he'd taken me out for that meal, and he applied for the position of Bishop of Minnesota. And he said by that time, 3 years had gone by, and he'd really pondered the role of bishop and its place in their church and what that would bring. And also, I guess Minnesota was a little less glamorous than Carmel. and he got the job. I think he still is Bishop of Minnesota, actually. So it was a failure from one point of view, but then very close to the surface, just below the surface, he realized, what a blessing that I failed. And when we start to reflect on the whole quality of success and failure, we begin to see that it's always just one particular point of view, that within every failure there are successes. Within every success there are failures. You know, the one turns into another. It's only when we see it in a very superficial way that we make this presumption that a success is an absolute good and a failure is an absolute bad. But actually, whether we call something a success or a failure is pretty arbitrary. You know, there's a famous story they tell in the Tibetan tradition about a poor family living in this village, and the only possession that this family has is one horse, a mare. And that's the only thing they have. They're dirt poor, and they're really struggling to get by. That's the one prized possession that they have. And then one day, the mare hops over the stone wall and escapes from the little compound and runs away off out of the valley. And so then the family are devastated. And, "Oh no, it was the one precious thing that we had. Now she's run away. And what are we going to do? We're lost. We're utterly lost. Now we're finished." And then Grandma takes this all in and says, "Well, maybe so." And then, while all the weeping and wailing is still going on, a few days later, lo and behold, the mare comes back down the valley and she has a stallion in tow, and comes back into the compound and says, "Oh, this is great! Now we've got a female horse and a male horse, and they can breed together. They'll produce foals, and then we can start a whole herd. You know, really, we're really made now. This is great. This is fantastic." "Well, that was really a blessing." And then Grandma says, well, maybe so. So then now that they got this stallion in their little yard as well, and they can build up the walls of it and protect them from running away. And the mare was a pretty quiet, safe ride, and pretty easy to potter about on, and yet the stallion is pretty frisky and agitated and very restless. Looks much more of an interesting ride to their young son, the teenage boy. Looks never that interested in taking the mare out for a ride, but the stallion looks like could really go fast. So one day and even though he's not supposed to ride the horse, of course, you ban a teenager from doing something, and immediately one is magnetized to that very activity. Since we've all been teenagers, I think we know this to be true. So the parents are looking in the opposite direction, they're busy doing something else in the fields one day, he thinks, well, I'll just take him out for a bit of a run, you know, because it's a nice day, and I'll go out and come back, and they won't even notice. So he hops on the stallion, heads out of the yard, goes charging off down the valley, and boy, you know, can the horse go fast. And he's thinking, this is great, this is fantastic, this is really wonderful, wow, you know, look at this guy go. And charging along, and then of course the stallion trips over a marmot hill. I think they have moles in Tibet, they have marmots, which are kind of large moles. So the stallion trips over a marmot hill, dumps the teenage boy on the ground, crack, breaks his leg. Ah! So then the parents notice that the horse, you know, the stallion comes back sort of puffing and panting, and then their son is missing, and so they go out looking, and then there he is, in a bit of a forlorn heap, you know, with a leg with an extra joint in it. Oh no, he was our only son, you know. Yes, now he's broken his leg, and he was going to grow up and run the farm for us, and now we're getting old, and now he's got a broken leg, he'll never be able to walk properly. Now we're ruined. Grandma predictably says, well, maybe so. And so they get him back, and they patch him up, and he slowly recovers, but he has got a bit of a limp. And then a little while later, a whole bunch of soldiers come through the village recruiting for the army. You know, they've got a local battle going on, and they need all the able-bodied guys they can muster up. And so all of the teenage lads, young men from the village, are rounded up and taken off to join the army, but they leave one behind because he's got a bad leg. So then he's the one that the only young man left in the village. And on and on and on and on. Yeah, it's one of those shaggy dog stories that never quite ends. And so every good fortune, Grandma says, well, maybe so. Every bad fortune, Grandma says, maybe so. And we can see within our own lives how this works. So, and also as I was reflecting today, you know, that here we all are, sort of, in this retreat, developing the Buddhist path. And we might think, oh, this is all great, you know, just deepening our meditation practice, deepening our faith in Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, committing ourselves more deeply and fully to the Buddhist way. We might think, oh, this is all great and good, you know, onwards and upwards. But to the Baptists down the road, you know, we're wedding ourselves to Satan ever more firmly and deeply. We're summoned into the heart of the evil one, you know. Right? You know, this is a disaster. They're probably even at this moment thinking, oh dear, what can we do? There's more Buddhists up at the Angela Center. The Catholics are bad enough, but the Buddhists are even worse. We should go and take them leaflets and offer to rescue them, because they're really doomed, damned. So, is it good or is it bad? Is it a success or is it a failure? You know? It just depends on how you look at it in many, many respects. So this is one aspect of reflecting on the feeling of fearing failure, desiring success. just to take it in and consider deeply, directly, how what we want or what we're fearing, if it happens that way, is it really definitely going to be a disaster? Can it only be a disaster, or could there be some good that comes from that as well? Can it only be a success that brings pleasure? Can it be an absolute good, or is there going to be other riders that go along with it as well? And so that we are not just being unconsciously or blindly pulled along by the attraction of success or the terror of failure, but we're expanding the view and considering, it's always this way. And one of the things that is also part of our cultural conditioning, and this is more of a sort of new agey sort of Hindu fatalist, also this kind of Judeo-Christian elements woven in there as well, but this strange mythology that grows up in our lives, that there is this right thing for me to do, right? There is the right path for me to follow. Ever had that feeling? There's this mysterious right thing that I should be doing, the right path, the right work, the right relationship, the right monastery, the right teacher, the right work that I should be doing. And when I find that mysterious right thing, then I will live happily ever after. Right? Even though when you spell it out, we start to think, not really. But it's because we don't spell it out that we actually get seduced by that. We follow it. It's as if, and the way it sort of takes shape in my mind, it's like there's this mysterious sort of hidden thread that we're like an electric cable that's sort of woven in a convoluted pattern under the carpet. We just have to sort of find it with our little metal detector. My true path. Beep, 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 beep. Here it is. I'm on my true path. Oh, no, I lost it. It stopped beeping. Beep, 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 beep. Oh, here I am. I'm on my true path again. It's as if there's this fixed, true thing I should be doing, this true work I should be doing, the right thing that I should be doing, the right thing for me to say, the right place for me to be. And then once I find that right thing, then I'll be happy. Everything will be in order. And it's not as though that there isn't a right thing. There is a right thing for us to be doing. But the fact is that the right thing changes millisecond by millisecond. So what's the right thing now is the wrong thing now. Right? It changes. And so that there's this strange idea that we have that if we just could find the right thing, then everything would be great. And if we miss the right thing, then it's a disaster. We're going to get it wrong. It'll be a fail. We'll fail because we didn't find our true path. We didn't find our true métier, our true thing, our true place. And that we set ourselves up for failure because of feeling that there's this fixed reality that we should be finding, and if we can't find it, then we've missed our chance, we've blown our shot. But I've been reflecting on and looking at life in a close way for a number of years, practicing meditation, and so that what I would suggest is more the case is that every moment brings with it an infinity of possibilities, and the choices that we make, might bring a painful result or a pleasant result or a neutral result. So even if we make a choice, we do something, or something happens, and then it's painful, we call a failure, we get something wrong, we make some comment that is, we think it's a wonderful wisecrack, and then it falls, as flat as several pancakes. Like you're expecting a nice chuckle, and then suddenly, whoom. Oh dear, that was very politically incorrect, wasn't it? They didn't get that one, did they? Oh. So we notice something's gone wrong. Something's painful, and then rather than then looking at that as an intrinsic bad, then we say, okay, well, where do we go from here? That didn't work out. That choice produced a painful result. I just injured myself, or I just said something that was hurtful to someone, or you know, that track that I thought was going to lead us through the forest, we now ended up in this swamp full of brambles. And any of you who visited Abhayagiri, you know we have abundant side tracks in the forest, mostly very steep and filled with poison oak, precipitous ravines, one kind or another. A few of you have staggered through them on little hikes and adventures. So when we find ourselves in one of those tricky spots or painful situation, the results of our actions have brought some sort of difficulty, rather than wallowing that, thinking, oh no, I'm a failure, I made this choice and it's come to this terrible place, I'm bad, I'm stupid, I'm wrong. Instead, just to say, okay, well that was a mistake, that's painful, okay, so where do we go from here? Similarly, if we make a choice and it brings forth some pleasant result, something, yeah, things work well, has a harmonious and sweet result. You're kind of making your way through the forest and suddenly you're out in a beautiful open clearing, level ground. A beautiful, clear spot that you never discovered before. So, oh, rather than, wow, look what I found, this is great, I'm going to name this one after me. This is going to be the Amaro clearing, because I found it! But, you know, claiming you know, this as some sort of wonderful thing for me and mine forever, just, this is a pleasant experience. This came to a good place. Okay, so where do we go from here? Rather than, I'm a success, I got it right, look at me, I'm wonderful. I don't know. Well, that one worked, okay, where do we go from here? Where does that lead us? So that rather than when we make choices, the identifying with that, yeah, and making it something very personal, just seeing that, well, there's a range of possibilities, trying this one, see where it leads. If it leads to a sweet result, okay, maybe keep following that. Take another step, where does it lead? And sometimes you find a whole succession of sweet effects that then bring you to the edge of a cliff. There's no way forward. Oh, well, it looked like we were heading in a good direction, but this is a precipitous drop. Okay, turn back. This wasn't the right way after all. So that we're not negating the fact that you know some results are pleasant, and bring helpful and good things, and some results are painful and bring obstructive and difficult things. But we're not taking it personally. And this is something that we can choose to do. That we get so identified with the decisions that are made, or the choices that are acted upon. I'm choosing, I've got to get it right, I don't want to get it wrong. All of that I is extra. If we're mindful, if there's a real observing, then they can see, well, there's an assessing of the situation. There's a drawing upon memory and intelligence and the patterns of the moment to see, okay, well, this looks like a good way forward. Let's try this, see what happens. And then if it's successful and things come out sweet, then we don't get drunk on it or carried away. If it's painful and difficult, then we don't take it personally. Don't break into a million pieces on account of it. And say, well, okay, well, that one didn't work, did it? Okay, let's try something else. Now, for years and years, I was... one of the reasons I've contemplated this a lot was because a few years into monastic life, I realized how enormously conditioned I was by the desire for success and the fear of failure, and that it was so deeply embedded I didn't even notice it was going on. It was just like an inarguable reality that to succeed is good, to please people is good, to make people happy is good, to come up with the right comments, to say the right things, and to carry out a job and for it to work well and for it to be praised is good. I mean, it's good. Of course it's good. And for things that you do to not work, or to be criticized by someone, or to say something and have people sort of mumbling and looking away, this is bad. It's really bad. And it was amazing that I was sort of 6 or 7 years into monastic life. You know, you think you're trying to be mindful all day long. It's a kind of full-time occupation, trying to pay attention to your mind and what's going on. I didn't even see it. And then I began to notice when it was at Amaravati Monastery, Ajahn Mehta lives, and I lived for 10 years. And every morning we have a kind of breakfast time gathering, and Ajahn Sumedho would sort of be in the centre of things, and he would give the morning reflections every day, and then we'd sort of sort out the events of who was going to do what. And there was often some kind of conversation or some exchange that went on in that situation. And I began to notice that if I said something and it fell flat, or I made some kind of supposedly witty remark or kind of wise observation, and then there was that sort of mumble, everyone looking at the carpet experience, then there would be this, what I came to refer to as the breaking into a million pieces aramana. The feeling of breaking into a million pieces, like, oh God, oh God, oh God, oh God, ah, no, no, sort of wailing as the heart shattered into a million pieces. And the opposite of that would be when I would make some sort of comment or make some sort of witty remark, and everyone, ha 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 ha, sort of lighting up and chuckling, and this profound glow of deep happiness. Amaro scored a point. Hooray! Unfortunately, I'm not entirely exaggerating. Embarrassingly enough. But being a full-time meditator, you start to notice these patterns forming, and look at that, you say one thing and then you fall into a million pieces, you say something else and it goes a different way, and then it's total happiness. The world is absolutely perfect. What's going on here? And I began to see that the mind was heavily conditioned towards wanting to succeed all the time, and that I'd throughout my life become sort of reliant on praise. And that, to be praised, to succeed is good. And that whatever it took to get that praise was worth it. And to fail was terrible, it was a disaster, it was the worst thing. And so along with that, I could see there was this undercurrent of anxiety that went with the whole process. Anxious to succeed, anxious in the face of failure. And I started to recognize, gee, I'm a really worried person. I've been carrying this around for years, my whole life, and it's so perpetual, it's so repetitive, I hadn't even seen it happening. And whether it was small things or large things, I began to see that was my basic response to life, was worry. Whatever it is, worry about it. If it promises something good, worry. You might not get the whole thing, or you might not get enough, or you might not get your share. If it's something that's going to be painful and difficult, you're going to fail at, then worry that people are going to notice. You won't be able to hide it. Well, it's going to really, really be embarrassing. I thought, this is dreadful. So I really began to appreciate some of the teachings that Ajahn Sumedho had been giving over the years, that when he was talking about anxiety, and I thought, oh yeah, that's very helpful for people. I've got a friend who's got a problem like that, And then suddenly I realized, I've got a friend who this applies to, Moi. That I could be applying this. And so and he would say how And I realized, I'd heard him say this dozens and dozens, hundreds of times probably, that when you notice a feeling of anxiety, if you pick up the sensations of the body, if you feel the body, notice the body, that anxiety, it forms like a knot of tension in the solar plexus. Now, different people find it in different places, sometimes in the chest or the throat, or the shoulders. But he was a solar plexus guy, and I found I was too. That whatever it was, whether it was something coarse or refined, whether it was something internal or external, whenever the mind was worried about anything, about getting to a meeting on time, or whether I was eating too much at the meal time, whether we were gonna, or someone liked the thing that I said, or whether I was, you know, giving a Dhamma talk that people found inspiring or dreadful, that whatever it was, in real or imagined, that there would always be this knot of tension in the solar plexus. So the kind of practice he encouraged, which I found extraordinarily helpful, was he'd say, okay, notice what it is that the mind's getting worried about. Missing, are we going to miss the plane? Are we going to be late? You know, what does so-and-so think of me? Whatever it is. Notice what the mind's getting worried about. And deliberately withdraw the attention from the object of anxiety and bring it into the body. Bring it to that feeling of tightness in the gut, in the solar plexus. Just notice what's there. And sure enough, every single time you feel this tightness in the belly. And then he'd encourage the response to that, just keeping your attention on that feeling, just consciously relax, let the solar plexus soften, let the belly just kind of relax and spread. Just stay with it for as long as it takes, half a minute or a minute or so. Just let the stomach, let the abdomen soften and spread, and feel the difference that makes. Notice the change in the emotional tone that comes with letting that knot unravel itself, letting the stomach soften. And when that's really clear, then try to go back to the thing that you were worried about. That's a really interesting piece of it, kind of the final element. Because more often than not, it's hard to even remember what it was that you were worried about. And what you find is that anxiety depends on physical tension, and that the more that the body's relaxed, the harder it is to sustain a good worry. And so often in retreats, those of you who've done retreats with me before know that I like to emphasize this, because it's a kind of magical thing. I mean, it's not really magical, it is extraordinary how it works. Like if you tighten your belly right now, if you kind of tighten your stomach, I'm doing it now, I instantly feel anxious. And there's no thing to be worried about, but you feel worried. And how often do we have that feeling of being worried and you don't even know what it is that you're worried about? Okay, so we're nicely uptight. Now, are we all worried yet? And consciously, just let it relax, let your stomach soften. Oh, it's nice, isn't it? Suddenly the world is a bit brighter, gentler, easeful. No worries. That's an extremely simple but direct way of working with anxiety. So when we're dealing with a fear of failure and wanting to succeed, it's this kind of combination of both using the reflective wisdom, using that power of consideration, like, well, what is it that I'm afraid of? And I also, along with this that kind of reflection, then also developing this physical awareness, mindfulness of the body, seeing how we hold the body. And it was when I first started to develop this, I actually, this is so central, I found that this was basically the core of my practice for about 2 or 3 years. Just mindfulness of anxiety. Just whenever the mind moved towards being worried about anything, just to come to the body. You know, notice the tension that was there, relax. And I also used to use this sort of verbal reflection. Yeah. Who's afraid? What's there to be afraid of? Just as a way of teasing things apart, just not being so embedded, believing in that anxiety. Who's afraid? What's there to be afraid of? And that when you spell it out, and you say, well, I'm afraid that the plane's going to go before we get to the airport. I'm afraid that the last of the apples is going to get taken before I get to the fruit bowl. I'm afraid that Venerable X doesn't like me. And that when you actually spell it out, you can hardly, I would find I could hardly ever get to the end of the sentence before there would be this, the insight would dawn of like, so what? So there are other planes in existence. So somebody doesn't like you. So you're going to be the first person on the planet that every other human being likes. That'll be a record. No one's ever done that before. Had every other human being they encounter actually, consciously like them. Even the Buddha, a totally enlightened, utterly pure-hearted being, had scads of people that thoroughly disliked him. And so when you use this kind of approach, explore that feeling, using these different elements, we find that it's not something that we have to be burdened with, buying into the value system of success and failure. Just seeing how spurious the whole thing is, how dependent, and not just using like the intellectual approach, but finding that the two depend on each other, that they developing a physical relaxation, just seeing the roots of anxiety, the roots of fear in the body, and how habitual, it's like the unconscious reaction to insecurity, to the feeling of self. So fear is a basic protective urge. Those ancestors of ours who weren't afraid were the ones that got eaten. So they were probably not our ancestors. The ones that were our ancestors were the ones that were afraid, that got out of the way of the tigers and the wolves and the other predators. So fear gets a bit of a bad rap. We think of it as a neurotic problem, but actually it's pretty useful stuff. If you don't want to get eaten, you don't want to fall over a cliff, it's kind of handy to have some fear. But it's where it overspills the bounds. It's when it's extended by the thinking mind. There's a very wonderful book by a psychologist at Stanford called Robert Sapolsky, called Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. He says the reason why zebras don't get ulcers is because if you're a zebra or a zebra, there you are out on the savannah, and a lion looks at you and says, aha, lunch. And once you realize the lion is coming at you, you run, and your adrenaline cranks right up, your digestive functions shut down, your reproductive functions shut down, your heart rate goes ballistic, and massive amounts of sugar go into your muscles, and you run as fast as you can. And there are two results possible. Either your speed is sufficient to keep you ahead of the lion, and then the lion gives up the chase, or your speed is not sufficient, and then you get eaten. So either way, you only need to keep that regime up for a certain amount of time, usually a couple of minutes. So after a couple of minutes, the lion gives up or gets another zebra, and you can go back to grazing. And if you've ever seen pictures, or you might have been out on the African savannah, and you see there are these zebras are sort of grazing away while, you know, the lions are tucking into, you know, Cousin Susie. You know, there she is being disemboweled by, you know, two or three lions. And this, you know, there they are, kind of Harriet and George and Mabel just chomping away as if nothing was happening while their, you know, their dearly beloved is getting disemboweled. How can they be so equanimous? They must be arahant zebras. They're not. They just don't have the thinking functions that we do, that says, oh my God, that could have been me, or that's going to be me tomorrow. I better move out of town and get to a different area. They don't seem to work that way. So they don't get ulcers because they don't imagine the future. They don't recollect the past. The conceptual thought that we human beings have, why we get ulcers, is because we can take that fear reaction, cranking up the adrenaline, cranking up the heart rate, lowering the digestive function, reproductive functions. We can take that emergency response and spin it out for weeks, months at a time, because of our imagination, the capacity to remember, the capacity to think, the capacity to imagine. So, hence stress, hence ulcers. That even when the lions are not, you know, right on our tail, we can imagine that they are. So we create ongoing habits of anxiety. So with dealing with this kind of issue of fear, anxiety, and particularly fear of failure, just to bring the attention down to what we're experiencing, kind of, and that capacity to question, what is it that I'm, who is it that's afraid, and what am I afraid of? What's there to be so anxious about? Yeah, questioning the object of it, challenging that, and then bringing the attention right down to the feeling of it. Okay, well, even if there is something genuinely to be worried about, I do care about getting that wrong, or someone is going to get hurt if I don't get this right. Okay, fair enough. Now, how does it feel? Where is it in the body? And then bringing it home to the physical experience of it. And then giving yourself permission to relax, to let go. And it's a miraculous thing. You know, when we relax the body, wherever you feel that quality of anxiety or fear, whether it's in your face or your throat or your belly or your shoulders, we consciously relax, so the world comes back into balance. And we still take care. You know, we do the best we can with the situation, and in fact, we find that we can work much more effectively, in a more appropriate and thoughtful, attentive way, when we're not guided by that current of anxiety and fear. We do the needful the best we can, and then if it works, you know, all well and good, that's very sweet, but we don't get drunk on it or carried away by it. And if it doesn't work, if it fails, then we don't beat ourselves up over it. So I found from working with this very, very directly for several years, a concept that I came to, or a way of phrasing things to myself, that was totally unthinkable when I started out was this phrase that I began to use as a reflection, which was, just do what you do and let the world make of it what it will. And when I first thought that, the habit of anxiety and fear of judgment of others just was like this enormous kind of eruption of like, what? What do you mean? It matters. This is kind of frantic panicking. What do you mean you don't care? Because the habit of caring, you know, compulsively and so afraid, you know, terrorized by getting it wrong or worrying what the world, they, think. But, you know, sometimes, even if you don't really believe it, sometimes bringing up a thought can be really helpful, just kind of setting a direction. And so just the extent of the panic that it induced told me that I was on the right track. So no, just do what you do. It's not that you don't care. It's not that you're numb and indifferent. You care. Do the best you can and let the world make of it what it will. You don't have to be the perfect monk all of the time. Just do what you can, do what you do. Some people will love it, some people will hate it. And then the feeling of relief that comes in the heart when you allow yourself to really to acknowledge that, to give some space to that, to allow the possibility of that, is enormous. And also, it was kind of surprising to me that when I stopped trying to be the perfect monk who never got anything wrong and who succeeded at everything, it was a big relief to everybody around me. Thank goodness he's got over that one. Like I've often told the story of how when I went to Ajahn Sumedho just before the winter retreat, I was trying to be the perfect monk that never got anything wrong. It was outpacing everybody. And I went to him and I said, you know, Lumpur, I've decided to give up all my ascetic practices. I never used to lie, for 3 years I never lay down to sleep. I used to strictly eat one meal a day. I never used a zafu to sit on. It was kind of flat on the floor, kind of real sort of old school, hard line, rusty nails for breakfast. Well, actually I had no breakfast. Not even rusty nails for breakfast. And so I said, I've decided, you know, it's just too burdensome, I'm going to give up all my ascetic practices. And I thought he was going to say, well, if you must, you know, it's been very good that you've been sort of making all this effort for so long, but, you know, if you have to, that's okay. But instead his response was, at last. Finally, you've got over that one. And I must confess, there was this sort of, oh. But in behind that, there was this, oh. Oh, I see. What a relief. And so I really encourage this entertaining this quality. You know, not, and it's not cultivating an indifference or a not caring. But in a way, it's a profound sincerity and a sort of a truthfulness to the situations that we meet. Just do what you do, let the world make of it what it will. Some people will praise you and think, oh, it's so wonderful the way she does that. That's so inspiring. That's so great. Someone else will feel, it makes me puke. She's so damn perfect. So annoying. Okay. You're not doing it to impress. You're not doing it to make people puke. Some people will be inspired. Some people will vomit. You know, it's just the way life is, and most will be somewhere in between. You know, and that this is really what you find is like that is being true to the Dhamma, true to the way things are, and that. It's a sincerity, it's a simplicity, and we discover there really isn't anything to be afraid of. When it comes to the very core of it, the very root of it, there isn't anything to be afraid of. You know, the Dhamma cannot be damaged, or lost, or defiled. It's always just what it is. So I offer these thoughts for consideration this evening.
Sadhu Kalanga Dasi.